Okay. All right. Well, okay. So you guys have heard a lot about the current strategic situation, both last night with Michelle Steinberg and also today with Val and Rob. So it's it's pretty daunting, to be honest, when you actually, as a young person, are looking at the prospect of having nuclear war as your future. Right? It's a little bit daunting. So what I want to go through tonight is not only Lyndon LaRouche's response, but also the only sane response to facing a dark age and to pulling humanity out of a dark age. And when Val said earlier today that we are conspiring against what these oligarchs intend to do to the world, I'm going to show you how we're conspiring. I'm going to show you what we're conspiring to do. So considering the quality of ideas that are currently dominating our culture, our universities, the United States White House, right? If ideas exist there, you really gotta ask yourself if our generation is gonna be able to succeed in our mission by just continuing the kinds of policy ideas that are in place today. Like, consider, okay, what if we extrapolate the current United States foreign policy 50 years into the future? What's that gonna look like? Or what if we extrapolate the currently prevalent view of economics, which is a lot of what Val and Rob went through today? What if we extrapolate that 50 years into the future? Would we even make it? So our generation is in a very unique position because we're actually not able to learn from our parents' generation. We're actually not able to take the lessons that they taught us as a generation and use them to contribute something ourselves to mankind. We have to pull ideas from somewhere else. And this is where creativity comes in, which we're gonna investigate a little bit. So we have we'll get into it, but obviously, since you've been told I'm gonna talk about Kepler, Kepler lived about 400 years ago. So that's one of the places we're gonna be pulling ideas from, reviving ways of thinking that, to be honest, haven't really been dominant in culture for maybe 100 years or more. So, okay. That being said, I want to start, well, before I put up the slide, how many of you guys have ever gone out on a very dark, clear night and looked up at the sky? Okay. What do you see when you do that?
Stars.
Stars.
Satellites.
How do you know it's a satellite?
Moving.
How do you know it's not just a moving star?
I was told it was a satellite.
I'm not going to have you.
Just your honesty.
I'm late in.
Well, what's a star look like? What do you actually see?
Light.
Yeah, all right. Light. Yeah. We have a name for it, stars, you know? Yeah. But it's honestly just a bunch of little dots of light. Which... Okay, so this is obviously not a photograph, but often if you lay on your back, this is pretty close to something you might see. If you had a really good telescope, you might see something like that. So there's a lot more up there than you might think. This is very beautiful, but it's also, to be honest, it's a little bit random. If that's the right word. When you first go out, it's kind of like this wash of light that's there. And there's, you know, I know obviously people probably know about constellations, that over the years, cultures have developed certain recognizable groupings and patterns of these stars. But for the most part, they're pretty much just everywhere, with no rhyme or reason, it seems. But if you stay out over the course of an entire night, or at least several hours, something interesting, you begin to see something interesting, but you don't see it with your eyes. You see it with your mind. Have any of you guys ever stayed out for a long period of time? No?
What's a long period of time?
Well, let's say 2 hours at least.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you notice over the course of 2 hours?
Rotates.
What rotates?
The screen that is the sky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It does something like that, right? This is a time, well, I guess this is a really long exposure of a photograph. And this is pretty really I thought this was really fun because this compresses into one image what occurs over several hours. And so somebody obviously made it visible to your eyes, but this is really something that's only visible to your mind when you're out making observations, or when early man was out making observations of the stars, of the heavens. So what do you guys see up there, actually? Yeah, what is that?
Circles form? Arches?
Yeah, they're like arcs, right? They're circular arcs. So immediately the mind, and we can see it, but if you're keeping track of this thing in your mind, you actually begin to, you assign a geometrical identity to the motion that's occurring to your senses immediately. Okay, now let me ask a question. Does anybody know what that is? Very close, actually. Has anybody ever seen this before?
The sun.
The sun. That's like 15 suns. More, yeah.
Bowling pin?
Not quite.
Is that like a time lapse?
It's a time lapse photograph, yeah.
Of the sun?
Uh-huh. What'd you say? Somebody back there?
I was just asking.
Richard Graham?
No. It is many positions of the sun.
Is that over a year?
Oh, it's the sun.
It's over a year.
Yeah.
Huh.
Mm. Wow, cool.
Yeah, if you picked, like, let's say you picked noon, or you picked one time of day, and every day, or maybe every couple days, you went out and you made an observation of the position of the sun over the course of an entire year, this is what occurs.
It's like a shape of a
cool.
Pringles chipper.
I think that's what John was thinking.
This has some food.
Cut out the munchies. Okay. So, something that you see every day, which appears pretty much the same, I'd say. I mean, I don't usually go outside every day and think, damn, the sun's like 1 degree, you know, further than it was yesterday. It looks pretty much the same. But, what uniquely human beings do is actually not only notice directly like sense impressions being blinded by the sun or the position of some scattering of stars, but we actually look for, well, we look for causes. And even though this photograph is a very recent photograph, this is something which ancient, well, at least the Greeks knew about. I don't know how far back, if it was further back than that, maybe the Egyptians at least knew about this phenomenon. It's called the analemma.
What?
Analemma. A-N-A-L-E-M-M-A. Analemma. So, something which we're fortunate enough to have a photograph of usually occurs in the mind. And it's funny because it's kind of like compressed time. This is an entire year's worth of motion contained within a single idea. So, well, you can imagine that mankind and human culture, as knowledge of these kinds of longer-term cycles such as this is passed on, you're bound to get pretty curious about what's actually going on up there and to start asking deeper questions when you go out and look at the stars. Because also, does anybody know what this is?
Retrograde motion. Mars?
Yeah, it's Mars. This is a similar phenomenon. This occurs over the course... Oh, actually, it's Mars and Uranus. You guys see that?
In the back.
Where?
Where?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were, yeah.
Isn't retrograding in the same way?
I don't think Uranus is in retrograde, but it was right next to Mars, while Mars was in retrograde.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. So this is something that occurs over the course of about 2 weeks. Just to give you guys a sense that it's not only the sun that does some strange things. So you can imagine as a young person, you would have a great sense of wonder as to what is going on up there. And just to show you guys something funny, this particular phenomenon was explained by followers of Aristotle, like this. So if you imagine that you're at the Earth, on the Earth, at the center of the universe, at A, this is what Ptolemy said that Mars was actually doing to explain the thing that I don't know how to go backwards to.
Well, you can the arrow, like
guys notice the sense perceptual similarity there?
Mm-hmm.
Between those two things? So, I thought that was kind of funny, but... Okay. So, the question is, are these things that are just kind of flying around up there? Some of them stay still and just rotate over the course of the night. Other ones do this, which is very weird. Some, you know, go backwards, or even the one in the background is just traveling. But it's traveling differently than the other set of stars. So, we're going to investigate the work of a great genius, which is Kepler, Johannes Kepler, who was born in 1571. So that's him. And you guys know what Europe was like in 1571? He's born in Germany.
We got a taste of it last night.
Yeah, right. Michelle did go through an idea of it last night. Yeah, Europe was in the middle of about 100 or more years of warfare in 1571 when Kepler was born. Germany wasn't even a nation. You had a bunch of principalities, and you had a bunch of lords and dukes, or not dukes, what are they called, barons, and things like that in Germany. They were all engaged in religious war against one another, all being manipulated by the great financial powers of Venice. And life was pretty miserable for the common man. But Kepler, though he obviously existed in his time, he wasn't exactly a creature of the Dark Age. He didn't reflect the Dark Age that he came from. And so he, as a very young man, well, relatively young, at the age of 25, he was sent off far away from his home to teach astronomy, which was, he recounts that he was kind of unsure about this thing because he really wanted to study theology. But he got a pretty broad education, and so he was sent to teach astronomy. And it was in the course of teaching astronomy that he actually made a great breakthrough discovery. And he discovered this, which is a model of the organization of the heavens. Just to explain this thing a little bit, each of the dishes, the bowls here, is the representation of all of the planetary orbits up through Saturn, which is the limit of what was known at the time. So you have the orbit of Saturn, and then you have a cube, which I'll explain in a minute. You have the orbit of Jupiter, and then you have a tetrahedron. You have Mars, then you have the dodecahedron, and then it's hard to see in here, but you have Earth, Earth's orbit, another, the icosahedron, another solid, which are actually all hanging up there inside of that. And then inside of that, you have the octahedron. And then inside of the orbit of Venus, you have the octahedron. And then the orbit of Mars, or Mercury, inside of that. Now, was Kepler actually saying that there are large structures up in space that are shaped like this? No. But what he discovered, and I would encourage people to work through it, because it's not a long work. A lot of people in this office have done extensive amounts of work on it, and it's something which can be rediscovered. But what Kepler discovered is that the same principle that you see organizing space in terms of these solid figures, these solid geometrical figures, that same principle of organization reflected there is also reflected in the heavens. And what he proved is that the distances of planets almost perfectly correspond to this kind of organization, as if there was a cube actually existing between Saturn and Jupiter, and as if there were a tetrahedron between Jupiter and Mars. And so, at the age of 25, he published a great breakthrough, which was a discovery of the cause of why the planets were at the particular distances that they were, and not some other distance, not some other organization. But he proved that the distances of the planets and the relationships to each other actually reflected a principle which was somewhat universal. So that's when he was 25, which is quite a young man. And so he discovered the causes of the distances, which it really set off a great shock in the scientific world of Europe at the time. But, as you guys know, planets don't just hang out in space, they move. And Kepler still didn't know the causes of the motions. He couldn't account for them. He had hypotheses, which are, I was delighted when I reread this work recently, and I didn't remember from the first time I read it, but he actually has all these kind of, just throwing out these different hypotheses, and he says, well, I'm not sure about this, but I just want to tell you guys what I think, and he throws out different ideas he has as to why the planets would have the particular speeds and motions that they do. Now about, I think it's like 12 or 13 years later, oh, that was 1596. In 1609, he finally, after a long correspondence with Tycho Brahe, who was this great astronomer of the day, he had extensive resources, he had the best observations that mankind had ever made so far. Kepler was in correspondence with him actually over this discovery for a long, long time. And I think it was like 5 years or something. And he finally was fortunate enough to go meet up with Tycho. And what he really wanted to do was get access to Tycho's data so he could check through Tycho's observations whether or not this was actually true. Because Kepler was working with data from Ptolemy, who was in like, I don't know, 200 AD or something, and Copernicus in the 1400s. So he wanted recent data. And while he was working with Tycho, he was kind of yanked into a project to figure out the motion of Mars, to figure out the orbit of Mars, which is that planet you guys saw making that weird loop in the sky. And that's a work which all the youth movement offices are currently in the middle of right now. So this is something which people can right now start working on and rediscovering. And I'm not going to go through it tonight, but I'll just say that what he did discover in the course of that, not only did he discover the specific motion of Mars and what the shape and exact position of the orbit of the planet Mars was, but he also discovered why it's moving, which is a question that nobody had really asked before. Why is the planet moving at all? And what's moving it? And the discovery was universal gravitation. Kepler was the first one to discover universal gravitation. So it was from this standpoint that he, that was 1609, it was from this standpoint that he actually went back to examining this hypothesis. And that's where the Harmony of the World, which is the work that I have been working on for the past 5 months, that's where it picks up. Because in the New Astronomy, his discovery of universal gravitation was a breakthrough in examining the relationship between the sun, the mover, and the individual planet. But our solar system isn't just one individual planet and one sun. We have, as he knew it, six planets. We know of many more planets, which all form a single solar system. And that's why Kepler went back to this hypothesis, because even though this does not deal with motion, it deals with distance, this hypothesis actually encompasses an idea of an entire kind of organized, fit-together system of planets. So in the Harmony of the World, Kepler is going back and he's examining his first hypothesis, and he's testing whether or not what he now knows about the motions actually corresponds to these distances. And that raises all sorts of problems that he doesn't know the answer to yet. Okay, so even though he wrote The Harmony of the Worlds in 1618, which is, you know, 9 years after The New Astronomy, it's many years after he wrote The Mysterium Cosmographicum, which is this work, ever since he was a young man, in letters to his teacher when he was a student, he would report, he would tell his teacher, Meslin, that he had an idea for a book. And he said, I have an idea that the heavens are composed on principles of harmony. And I intend to write a book on this. And he actually laid out what the different chapters of the book would be. And he said, well, I can't write the book yet, because I don't know the answers. But I'm positive that the Creator would have composed a harmonic universe, a beautiful universe. And that's when, I don't know, he was very young then, probably 20, you know. So, you know, now in 1618, when he was however years old, 40-something, 47 years old, he finally is able to write this book. Now, to kind of back up a little bit, can you guys see harmony? What is harmony? What kind of thing is it?
Is it like a concordance between one thing and another?
Okay. Sure. That's one idea of it. Okay, well, can you see that? Can you see the concordance?
You can see the discordance, but you can't see
the Well, how can you see the discordance?
It would manifest itself in a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Like a fight between two people, in a sense.
Most discordance. Well, you see the effect of it for sure. If you, yeah, you mean human beings, right? You have concordance and discordance between personalities often. Yeah, a conflict, like a fight, that's definitely an effect of discordance for sure. But what about the discordance itself? Or justice? Can you see justice?
Not with your eyes, if that's true.
Not with your eyes. Yeah, nobody's ever, like, tasted gravity. You know? I really like the flavor of gravity. So, it's funny when you think about the fact that Kepler as a young man was positive that this quality of harmony existed in the universe, when it's not something you can see. And certainly, if you think back to the stars, like, I'll just go back for a second here. I mean, you talk about harmony, some kind of concordance, that seems pretty, you know, random, as I said earlier. So the question that LaRouche's intent that we master is not only the specific discovery of universal gravitation, the specific discovery of what's organizing the motions of the planets, but he's also challenging us to actually know what a principle is and how you go about investigating, the discovery of a principle of somebody like Kepler. But more importantly, how do you actually investigate your universe? How do you know what kind of universe you live in? What's your method for actually knowing a principle which is insensible, intangible, but it's very real, and it has a very real effect in determining the course of events? So, okay, in order to do this, Kepler begins his whole book on astronomy with this here. That's how he begins his entire book. Now, what is this?
Circle.
Okay, what's a circle?
It's a cut of a sphere.
It's a cut of a sphere. Where'd the sphere come from?
God.
Put it in a
Well, does anybody remember, like, from geometry class, what a circle is supposed to be?
Equal distance from a center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like an infinite number of points equidistant from some center. Mm-hmm. Well, I know somebody was bringing it up earlier, but LaRouche, as a 12-year-old, was presented with that idea, and he rejected it. And he said, okay, well, what I think that thing up there is what you cut into a steel beam to make it stronger. Like, something like that. Yeah, it's funny, huh? Or, like, actually, think about this. If you were out doing observations and you were standing next to a friend and you were trying to point out two stars, what would you do? Like, I don't know, people pick a point on the wall and point at it. And then pick another point and move to that. What shape does your finger trace out?
A line.
Really?
Can you do it? It's like an arc.
Here, yeah. Why don't you watch him? Can you do it? Can you point to a point above your head and then to a point in front of you? Watch what shape his finger takes.
It's an arc.
Yeah, it's an arc. Mm-hmm. Well, what if this is just the shape that your finger takes when you're doing astronomy? Mm. Or, actually, I really like this one. I'm going to pull something up. Is there any other way to throw that thing? Could you throw that thing without making a circle with some part of your body?
Like a frisbee?
What?
I don't think
it's
it would go very
though,
far. Oh yeah, that's true.
you could give it one.
Look at that, man.
You lose.
Wait a minute, this guy is really serious. Look at him.
Watch the ending.
Wait.
It's
he's
like three different
he's doing it
oh.
many times, like five different tries.
The ending is crazy, like it's all planned out.
One of the most famous statues of ancient Greek antiquity is of a discus thrower.
Yeah.
But what was neat about the Greeks is that it was he's portrayed in the moment of motion. That's the Greeks. All of the greatest art was always portraying motion.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Romans, it was always stationary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Enough of that.
Okay.
So Kepler begins. So Kepler begins his book on the harmony of the motions of the planets by discussing the circle. And obviously it's not from, well, maybe it's not obvious, I won't say that. I'll just put this up so you guys can hear what Kepler himself says.
Yeah.
You want to read
Radio?
It?
No.
No,
you want
no.
Read?
Yeah, I'll just read it.
Okay.
Okay.
For shape and proportion are properties of quantities. Shape of individual quantities and proportion of quantities in combination. Shape is demarcated by limits. Therefore, finite things which are circumscribed and shaped can also be grasped by the mind. Infinite and unbounded things, insofar as they are such, can be held in by no bonds of knowledge, which is obtained from definitions, by no bonds of constructions. For shapes are in the archetype prior to their being in the product, in the divine mind prior to being in creatures, differently indeed in respect of their subject, but the same in the form of their essence. Hence, by the same reasoning, one who gives limits to quantities as their essential basis supposes that quantities which have shape have an intellectual essence.
Mm-hmm. Is it clear what he's saying? Somebody have an idea of what he's saying?
Want to
try to explain it?
Is he saying that if we think in terms of infinities, it's outside our grasp? Like an infinite number of points across, like an infinite number of points around the sun, it's something we can't grasp. So.
Well, maybe not that we can't grasp it, but that we can't grasp it. Remember what he says. It's held in by no bonds of knowledge obtained from definitions, like any kind of axiomatic, like what Euclid was doing. You know, because it's, and this is the whole point of gravitation. He just had discovered universal gravitation, something that filled the entire universe. It doesn't have a shape, so you can't grasp it by any kind of predefined notions of geometry or whatnot, but that doesn't mean it can't be grasped by the mind.
It reminds me of something I read in the briefing this week on how the LIM in Washington right now, they have to go into the Congress and organize these congressmen. In a way, they have to understand, they have to teach what the work on Kepler we've been doing to these congressmen, but not so that they can just repeat a set phrase, a sentence, a catchphrase that resumes it all, apparently, and that to say that these guys could pretend that they didn't understand it. The idea has to be discovered in another way, or has to be understood in another way, which is not resumable in a 30-second sentence.
Mm-hmm. Like a way, there has to be a way for the mind to actually grasp the concept.
Yeah.
Mhm. Yeah, it's like if we go back to this slide here. I mean, this is sort of, maybe you could say that this is kind of unbounded in a sense, that there's no form. This is an infinite spattering of stars. So if that's what you were limited to, if you could never actually put some kind of relationship to this, and it just remained this kind of infinite wash of stars, would it ever be possible to know what was going on up there? And as an example, and we'll get a little bit into what he's talking about more specifically. Oh, and to do that, I have to take down this thing here.
That's like Socrates, too, maybe, in a way, isn't it? Like, the way that he has these dialogues with people, and they're always trying to apply these really limited definitions to this, whether it's justice or virtue or something like that. And he keeps showing them that you don't get the whole idea. You can't put some finite definition on an idea like that.
Okay. We're going to do some experimenting with the circle. He does a lot of it. He does like 100 pages of it in the book. But
this is a big eraser here.
Oh, thanks.
Least action.
So, okay, it's not a perfect circle, but imagining that it were a perfect circle. Is there any, like, part of the circle, any region, particular region that's different than another?
In that one.
Pretending.
Oh, okay. I missed that part.
Well, you mean in what we observe or in its essence?
Well, what you see. Is there really any part, you know, supposing it were an irregular circle because of my drawing, is there any part that's distinguishable from any other? Would it matter if I turned the thing? Would it look any different?
Nope.
No.
Well, okay.
Do you disagree?
No, but...
Oh.
I thought you were asking a different question.
No. Just on what you see. Okay. So it's pretty uniform. It's everywhere the same thing. Mm-hmm. Continuous. But if we begin to act on the thing, something emerges. Like, for example, say I draw a line through the center of the circle. And you can either do that because you use the compass to create your circle and you know where the center is, or you actually can find the center of a circle. Just given the circumference, which people can work on later. It's pretty fun. So, supposing I projected a line through the center, which is a point of singularity, inside of the circle. Now I've defined, now I have something which is different, right? I've kind of brought difference to what was before the same. Because if I turn this thing, right, I have two distinct regions defined. If I turn the thing, you'll obviously notice the difference. So there's some kind of boundary put to the circle now. So I did that. Now, who wants to come up and divide the circle into four regions, four parts? What angle is that at the center?
What angle?
Mm-hmm.
Like 90 here?
Yeah.
90 degrees?
Yeah, it's 90 degrees. The circle's just on our whiteboard, right? We kind of just made it. We put it up there. It's ours. I made it up. So, if that's the case, and if this thing is just purely like on the whiteboard or on your, you know, in your notebook, something you make up, I should pretty much be able to do whatever I want with it. If it has no consequence, or no, if it's not a reflection of the physical universe. So, if that's the case, then, well.
Sorry.
Oh, if that's the case, then why is it specifically 90 degrees at the center, a 90 degree angle at the center, that defines 1/4 of a circle? Or maybe it's better to put it another way. Could you have chosen a different angle and divided the circle into four equal parts?
Nope.
Yeah.
Like if I'm the ruler of my circle and it's mine, could I have chosen a different angle here Let's say I wanted to choose, you know, 60 degrees as the angle here. Would that divide, would this arc be exactly 1/4 of the whole circumference?
No.
No. Right. I mean, it's kind of a strange way to put it, to put the thing. But when you start to look at it, I mean, you didn't really have a choice of what angle you were going to make at the center, right? To divide the circle into four equal regions. It's almost as if there was something about the circle that forced you to make that particular line. And kind of, you know, guided your hand almost, you could say. Okay, so there's a little bit more to the circle than may appear on first glance. All right, how would you divide the thing into three parts? Anybody want to come try with that?
Not as obvious.
Anybody know how to do it?
No, I don't know.
How about eight parts? Skip ahead.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, somebody come do it.
Give it a shot.
Mm-hmm. Could you do 16?
Hmm.
The other one should be good.
That's all right.
The black's gonna work. Yeah.
Garrett, and if I ask you to do like 32, 64, you could do it, right?
Just dividing into
each
one, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's the same process. You generate and you keep generating these polygons. I'm gonna leave the three for now. That's actually a challenge. If people don't know how to divide the circle into three parts, they should figure it out. Because just by this process of cutting in half, like you were doing, we didn't get to three. We went right from 2 to 4 to 8. So three wasn't anywhere in there.
Well, it is.
Where?
Well, the 90 and half of the other 90.
Come do it. From here, 90, mm-hmm. This is another 90, mm-hmm. But this half, can you draw it? It's 30, okay? So it gives you 120. This,
neck, that doesn't work.
Why?
No, because I can't see, I mean, the marker.
The marker doesn't leave
oh.
it. When it don't work, you should just
Kay.
Throw them away.
Is this is 90, right? Mm-hmm. This is the other 90. You cut this 90 into half, it gives you 90 and 30, which is 120. So this angle here...
Wait, 90 cut in half is 45.
Dang! Why is that? Okay,
fine.
No.
Really?
Really, 90 and half is 45.
I know, but I don't know. So 120.
Okay.
Yeah, but how do you do it without, so you don't know the angles or how they construct it geometrically, and it's a different question.
Yeah, that's
intuitive.
Well, yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to, no, before I do that, so, oh man, I got to do this thing now. So Kepler looks at, in dividing the circles, he looks at the fact that in dividing the circle, kind of as a secondary consequence, you generate geometrical figures that we're all familiar with, things like squares, which is...
Sorry.
Right. Dividing a circle into four, like you did, actually generates a square inscribed inside of that circle. So Kepler takes up a whole investigation into the kinds of quantities that you get from doing this. And, for example, and people, if they haven't looked at it, should look at it later. But, for example, the side of a square is what we say incommensurable with the diameter. If you wanted to put a number to it, it would be an irrational number. But a better way to think about it is that this line can never be measured by this line.
They're not proportional?
No, there's no like smallest part
oh.
that'll fit into both this line and that line. There's no smallest measurement. So they have no way to be compared.
The number in decimal form just keeps going and going and going?
Yeah, that's another way to say it. Mm-hmm. So he starts examining these quantities, and he eventually comes to the idea that you can construct any polygon inside of a circle if you only know the proportion, or how to construct the proportion, of the side to the diameter. And once you know that, simply by making the appropriate cut of the diameter and swinging it around, you can construct the figure. So I'm going to cheat and show you the one way to construct a pentagon. One way. Okay.
You'll forget.
Don't worry. So just give me an electric a jolt for the end of the night.
So what's going on now is we're cutting the radius into the golden section proportion. And on our website, we have a whole long thing on the golden, exploring the golden section from the standpoint of astronomy. So that line's cut into the golden section. So this is the swinging around that Kepler's talking about.
How do we get the
Is that half the radius?
It's not half the radius. It's the radius. It's a golden section proportion of the radius.
Well, can you back up to see how you got there?
Oh, God. We'll play it again. We'll let it play again. Okay, so that creates the 10-sided figure. And we simply connect every other point to get the pentagon. So this is just kind of fun, showing you that the golden section, any yellow dot you see is a cut into the golden section. And you're back to the decagon. So we'll go through it again. This is
what's that original length right there?
Is it half
this is the radius.
Right?
Okay,
this is half the radius.
Half.
Mm-hmm. This is actually Euclid's construction of the golden section. This is on the website.
What was the bottom line?
Huh? It was that line swung down. This if you it's Euclid's construction.
Does that mean it's not good?
No. I'm just telling you where to find it. That's where you can find it.
Okay.
You're gonna look at it. So that creates a decagon, 10 sides. I know that was kind of quick, but I showed it to you so you can see that even, well, figures like the pentagon, which are a little more complicated and involve things like the golden section proportion, can still be constructed. And Kepler goes to that. And he also goes through not only that it can be constructed, but that every length inside of that, like all the little lines that are cut by other lines, their quantities can all be known and constructed as well. Now the question is, does anybody know how to construct the 7-sided figure? Heptagon. Has anybody done it?
What did you call it? A
heptagon. 7 sides. Why do you say it's impossible? Why?
I never tried.
No.
It's right there. The Pentagon.
Mm-hmm. Well, the heptagon is just a figure with seven sides, right? Empirically, it's not any different than the pentagon. It just has two more sides. Can you pull this thing up?
Three, five, seven.
But so yeah, three is the one we didn't get. Okay, so I have, this is a diagram of a heptagon. So you guys can see one. Seven sides. So like I said, it doesn't really look much different than if you had a pentagon in there, it just has more sides.
Cool.
Yeah. How did I construct it?
I see something.
Yeah, I'll tell you why that's there in a second. Hold on a sec.
Does it have the same
idea? Okay. Could somebody please read what Kepler says about the heptagon?
Oh, it's you.
Oh, my God.
No, not there. Like
it's in the computer.
Really?
Oh, no, it's a ghost in the computer.
What do I do?
Yeah, I don't know how you do that.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was like you moved the arrow.
Yeah. Oh, can you go back?
Just press the escape and go back. And
move the window?
Huh?
Move the whole window?
Okay.
No. Yeah, you have to like grab it and move it.
Put
it
down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hold
on.
Make it bigger.
No. Shit.
No, you did it with your.
What if you just move the projector?
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's not.
The
yeah.
Oh, there it is.
Okay.
Yeah, like that.
Okay. Oh, God.
Oh. Do it with your arrows.
Hey, why don't I just not?
Just read.
Yeah.
Arrows on the.
Can somebody people read that a little?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not the same.
It's pretty small.
Oh.
Arrows. Yeah. Send it with your arrows.
Just make it bigger.
Send it with my arrows?
No.
Okay, I'm just going to put it right here. And maybe somebody can read it.
That's cool.
Can somebody read that? Val? You can't see that? You want to read it?
Yeah, but I had a question.
Okay.
What did you call the principle of the golden what?
The golden section.
The golden section.
Yeah, on our website we have one of my friends, Rihanna, and also my friend Vinny put together a whole study of it that they did looking into sphere, like the sphere, geometry of the sphere, astronomy. Also, just planar geometry.
Whose idea was the golden section?
I don't know who. The Greeks knew about it.
Was it Kepler? Was it
God? No. It was ancient. It was known to the ancients. Yeah, read the thing on the website. We go, like, my friend Rihanna goes a lot into just different hypotheses about that.
You want me to read?
Yeah, could you read the quote?
For here indeed we are concerning ourselves with entities susceptible of knowledge. And we correctly maintain that the sign of the heptagon is among non-entities that is not susceptible of knowledge. For a formal description of it is impossible. Thus either can it be known by the human mind, since the possibility of being constructed is prior to the possibility of being known. Nor can it be known by the omniscient mind by a simple eternal act. Because by its name, it is among unknowable things. Oh, excuse me. Because by its nature, it is among unknowable things. It remains, therefore, that for all these objections, for all the frustrated attempts by all these scholars, the size of figures of this kind are by their very nature unknown and unknowable. So it is not to be wondered at that what could be not could not be found in the archetype in the world is not expressed either in the structure of the parts of that world.
Mm-hmm.
So it is, let me just read the last sentence again.
Okay.
So it is not to be wondered at what could not be found in the archetype of the world, which is not expressed either in the structure of the parts of the of that world. So if it doesn't exist in the world, it can't be known? What does that mean?
Well, he's in the archetype of the world, or in other words, of the pattern of organization of things.
Okay.
I mean, Kelber just said that God doesn't know the heptagon, though. I don't know if you guys caught that.
Yeah.
Not even God can know it.
The omniscient mind is gone?
Yeah. That's pretty bold. Not even God can know the heptagon. At least he says, cannot know it by a simple eternal act. And there's some fun with that on the website, on our website too. The long examination of the heptagon.
What does he mean by that? If he just created it out of nothing, he wouldn't understand it?
Well, the question is, can you actually construct a heptagon? Is it possible?
Mm-hmm. So what did you just show us before? Was
I'll show you in a second. Well, what I showed you was my computer program fudging it.
Yeah, well, and
you can produce something that's really close, right?
You can divide like the angle so like 360 by 7.
How do you divide that by 7?
Accurate.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll just show you.
Gauss did that,
didn't
he? No. He was trying to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nope. Okay, so I'll just give you a sense. We don't have time to go through the whole thing tonight, but I'll just give you a sense of maybe of why the heptagon is such a problem. You see here, this is a heptagon, right? This is what Kepler calls the base angle of it. And then you would have an identical one over here. But you see how this angle is actually cut into three equal parts by the side of the heptagon? So if there were a heptagon existing within a circle, its angle would be trisected by the other sides of the heptagon. And then, I didn't draw it, but this angle here would also be trisected by these three sides here. Actually, this is a fun challenge. I do want to do it. Why does it come up? In the book? He brings it up as the primary example of the classes of figures that you cannot construct. And he's saying if it's inconstructible because its quantity is unknowable, its proportion is unknowable to man, it's also unknowable to God. And so God wouldn't have used it when he fit the heavens together.
He's not keeping something away from us?
No, he's not. okay. So, just to get at why this cutting the angle into three parts might be a problem. if you have an angle like that, if this angle were trisected, or cut into three equal parts, like that, wouldn't it be the case that this angle, you can see that this angle would be cut in half by that line, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this angle would be cut in half by that line.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So, hey Val, are you going somewhere? Do you want to do this for me? Here. So supposing you start out with an angle and a marker. How would you know? How would you do it? Where would you put your first line? For what is this? You want to cut that angle into three equal parts. So where would you draw your first line?
Third of the way out.
Okay. Go for it.
Well, I don't know where that is. So, I don't know, I can guess.
Okay, that's fine. Guess and then we can correct it if it's off. Okay. So, since you put that line there, remember what I was showing you before about the lines bisecting each other?
Yep.
Like that? So you just put this angle, which means that since you put a line there, you automatically determine where your next line goes.
Mm-hmm.
You see what?
Yeah. Does it have to be the same angle?
Yeah. Either this has to be the same angle as this, Or you think of it as what's left has to be bisected.
Yeah.
By what you draw. Now, how do you know where to place the first line such that your second line, which is automatically determined for you, is going to perfectly fit those parameters? To be extreme, if I made my first line here, and then I had to my second line was going to bisect what's left, those would not be equal, right? So it's a problem where you actually have to determine the placement of two magnitudes as a single act, simultaneously. Because as soon as you draw one line, you've already determined the other one. And so as Kepler says, this does not exist within the domain of the circle. It doesn't exist. You have to look to conics.
Meaning you can't do something, two things at once?
Nope. So that's a pretty famous problem of trisecting an angle. And we have a lot of stuff on the website about that. Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. So,
the heptagon can be constructed?
Well, it doesn't exist within the domain that Kepler is looking at for the construction of the heavens. It's unknowable there. Completely unknowable.
In the circle, you mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you can't construct it in the circle, does that mean it's impossible to construct as such?
Well, it's kind of a more complicated question because it involves conics. It involves using conic sections. But the question of being able to construct a conic section on a plane is not such it's a tricky question. Of actually being able to truly construct a curve, an irregular curve like a conic section on a plane. So Rihanna from our Seattle office wrote a really good pedagogical on that. I can't find my chart. Okay. Okay, so this is just briefly. He sets up three main classes of figures, of constructible figures, at the end of book one. And you see, so you have the square, what you're doing with bisection, you can create the octagon, the 16-gon, 32-gon, and on forever from there. So he has these three different polygons as kind of like the heads of the family, of these different classes of figures, of which there are infinite number if you just keep doubling the sides. And that's kind of that's how he wraps up book one. So what Kepler's looking at is he's saying, okay, these proportions, which are defined by being able to construct a division of a circle, for example, 3/4, which would be just taking three of my four cutoff parts here. These proportions, Kepler says to himself, these proportions are the ones which were available to God when he constructed the motions of the heavens, when he fitted the system together. So what he does next is he investigates these proportions not as distinct, separate classes, but he asks himself, how can they be compiled into one subsuming system? And for that, he has to go to the domain of music and musical harmony. So, are the speakers functional?
On? You just have to. No.
No.
I just have to turn on.
Okay. So,
okay. I might have to control all of my.
So looking at these lines, these three lines, which one do you guys think, A or B, is exactly half the length of the big one?
I think it's your mouse. If you push your mouse to the right, push.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Is it like one of those obstacles?
maybe. Which one do you think?
B.
Yeah.
These seem pretty good.
Yeah. I'm sticking by an obstacle.
They're different. One of them is half.
Yeah.
Well, look at it with one eye.
All right. All right. What's even better than that? Okay. So some of your senses are ill-equipped to it. Judge proportion exactly, which some of you guys going like this can tell. Just looking at them, to be honest, you can't be sure if either is exactly half. Mm-hmm. But you were given 5 senses, and your ears are a little bit better equipped. So I'm going to let you guys hear both of these proportions as if they were a length of string. And we don't have a monochord, or if we do, I didn't ask. But that's okay. We have a virtual monochord. So if you had a string which is this length, what you're going to hear is a string of this length sounding,
okay,
as if it were plucked, and then a string of this length sounding, and then also that length. I'll play the two. The first, or one of them is going to be these two strings together, and the other is going to be these two strings together.
Because you have a portion, you need 2 lines to play. You play an interval.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have 2 tones.
You can't play just a line; you have to play an interval, 2 lines together.
In order to hear proportion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm gonna try B first, since that was the popular one. Actually begin to compare the different proportions in a way that he couldn't just by looking at them. So we do have a monochord. Maybe we want to play with the monochord afterwards, but we have a virtual monochord. Here. So my friend Michelle made this, and this is a virtual monochord. I'm going to have you guys sing it though as well. But what she did is, you can see over here, she has the polygons kind of simultaneously inscribed in the circle. So you have a triangle which divides the circle into 3. So you have given the proportion of 2 to 3, for example, or 1 to 3. You have whatever this is, the octagon, this kind of light green thing. The octagon inscribed in the circle. So you can have 5/8, you can have 3/8, etc. So I guess what we should do now is, what I want to do is, I want you guys to hear the different proportions that we kind of touched upon looking at the polygons in the circle. So what I'm going to do, let's first do the division into 2 parts. So what I'll do is, I'll push the buttons for the 2 tones so you guys can hear it, and then I'll have you guys sing it. Okay. Why don't the women sing that note? So go. No. And the men sing this.
No.
remember that note. There, I'll play it again. You sing, yeah, the women will sing this note. So you guys just... So you guys just sang a proportion of 3 to 4. So it's as if the men were singing the tone that you would get from a string 4 inches, feet, whatever, 4-something long, and the women sang a string of 3. You guys want to do it again?
Yeah.
So listen. So you're actually hearing a proportion. You're hearing the relationship of 3 to 4.
Huh.
Okay, men? Would you guys say that that's harmonic or not?
Yeah.
I would too. It's kind of nice. Okay.
So that...
Alright, let's do the triangle, which we haven't constructed yet. Okay. Oops. Sorry. I can't hit the wrong button. Okay. Then...
Are you?
No. Yeah. Women? Within an octave, or between 1 and 1/2. This is all the whole series of tones you would generate from the constructible figures.
Like you just went up an octave in sound.
No, the first note and the last note were in an octave relationship to one another. And the ones in between were in between. But what I'll show you guys, he actually is, he's very rigorous. And what he does is he takes these proportions And he starts comparing them and looking at what's the difference between two-thirds and three-fourths. And he comes up with smaller intervals, smaller proportions between proportions. And from this, he actually constructs something, which I will show you. So after he takes all of the constructible polygons and all the proportions between the proportions, he comes up with this. Sebastian, who's a member of our youth movement in Berlin, we had him play on the cello. And so in order to get the exact right proportions, we had a piece of paper under his cello string. So that's just him correcting to make sure he was right on. So yeah, the proportions don't. So what Kepler does is he takes this whole series, and for particular reasons, which we don't have time to go into now, for particular reasons, he separates out all these tones into these two scales, which I'll play for you. So not all of the tones are in one, like each of the scales, but they're all there, except for a couple which he uses other places. Them hard and soft, because he says the soft melody is easier on the ears. Mm-hmm.
Soft is the major or the minor?
Minor.
Soft is what we call minor. Yeah, he says the soft melody is easier on the ears. He says it glides into the ears. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is which you literally are hearing the proportions you get from geometry in sound, constructed into a single system.
Is that just by chance?
What do you think? It would be a very fortunate coincidence. But it's interesting, because it means that there's something rational about the musical system, not just based on opinion. Because there's something rational about the geometrical figures, right? They're not just arbitrary, left up to your opinion. You can't just, like, will to construct a heptagon. You do it, you know?
You can if you believe you can.
I'm going to put your ears to the test, then. If you did construct a heptagon, this is what you might hear. Taking 5/7 of the string, which reflects the heptagon, if you could make it. And then also if you want to hear 4/7 of the string. Is that harmonic?
No.
No. It's unknowable.
Is that does that dissonance just arise with the 4/5?
Everything sevenths. Everything ninths. Everything elevenths. Mm-hmm. Not exactly. It's close to it. It's around there, but it's not exactly. So you start to get a sense of how to investigate, how to investigate the universe around you. So you've kind of seen a principle of harmony reflected in the proportions that make the musical system. You can kind of think back on the same principle of harmony really was there the whole time in the geometry. We just weren't really examining it with the right microscope, you know. We weren't really looking at it in the right realm, but it was there. So Kepler now takes this musical system, which is quite beautiful, which man constructs. I mean, man constructed this musical system. He didn't just find it under a rock. You know, he made it. And so Kepler takes his musical system, which is completely lawful, and he sort of holds it up to the heavens for comparison. Which is this. Can somebody read that?
Now 18 months after the first light, 3 months after the true day, but a few days after the pure sun of that most wonderful study began to shine, nothing restrains me. It is my pleasure to tell mortal men with the candid acknowledgement that I still am the golden vessels of the Egyptians to build tabernacle to my God from them, far, far away from the boundaries of Egypt. If you forgive me, I shall rejoice. If you are enraged with me, I shall bear it. See, I cast the die, and I write the book. Whether it is to be read by the people of the present or to the future makes no difference. Let it await its read for 100 years.
Oh, reader, sorry.
Huh?
Let it await its reader, I should say.
Oh, let it await its reader for 100 years. If God himself has stood ready for 6,000 years for one to study him.
Oh,
the
18 months thing?
Yeah.
He's just giving you kind of a poetical date. He's just saying, like, at this time, finally now. I don't know exactly what all that's referring to. He's referring to a point in time. Okay, so what Kepler proceeds to do is he proceeds to take the knowable harmonic proportions and he seeks them in the heavens. He looks for them amongst the planetary motions. Well, just amongst the planets, period. And he starts out with the distances, actually, which is kind of, he starts out with the distances, I think, because that's what he already knew. He had already discovered the cause for the distances. So, what's the next? Yeah, this is kind of blurry because I had to take it from a PDF. But so this is a chart from the book where Kepler's looking at the six planets here. You see Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. And he's looking at two of their distances because the planets don't travel in perfect circles. So they're not always the exact same distance from the sun. So there's going to be a moment when the planet is the farthest from the sun that it'll ever get, and then the closest that it'll ever get. And Kepler chooses to look at these particular points as defining, kind of bounding something about the orbit. So the aphelion refers to the farthest distance, and the perihelion refers to the closest distance. So what he does is he takes the data for each planet of the two extreme distances, and he compares them to see if they come close at all to any of these proportions, which took part in the musical system, like two-thirds, three-fourths, five-eighths. And as you see over here, not really. For example, Saturn comes kind of close to 9/10 or maybe 8/9. It comes somewhere in between 9/10 and 8/9, which is actually a dissonant proportion anyway. Jupiter is not really close to anything, proportion-wise. Mars is somewhere between 6/5 and 5/4, somewhere in there. Earth is a very, very small interval. A diesis is like a really small half step. Very, very small. It's very dissonant. Venus makes almost no interval at all. If you see, its closest distance is 719, and its furthest is 729. So it's almost the same. And Mercury makes something which she says is less than the harmonic 8 to 5. More than a fifth and less than a sixth. So he doesn't find the harmony in the distances. So what he does is he goes through a whole process of looking for the harmonies and just different aspects of the planet's orbits. And he finally comes to the conclusion that it has to exist in the motion, in the motions. And the reason he gives in the book, which is, he says, well, you know, a vibrating string is in motion. Sound comes from motion. Therefore, it's right. It fits that it would be in the motions. And then he proceeds to examine it. And he starts out with this axiom, which I think is funny. I don't know, Val, you want to read it? No? Sorry.
It is fitting that in any place, whatever, where it could be so, between the extreme motions, both of individual planets and of pairs, harmonies ought to have been established of all kinds, so that much variety should adorn the world.
That's such a
such variety.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So this is his number one axiom that guides his reasoning throughout the rest of the book. So, so what does he do? He seeks the harmonies in the motions of the planets, the fastest and the slowest motions of the planets. And I just want to kind of go a little bit of an aside on the planetary motions, because these things, he had to do a hell of a lot of work. It's not, you can't just, like, look up at the planet Mars and say, oh, that's going, you know, a million miles an hour, and then Jupiter's going half a million miles an hour. You can't just do that. There's a lot involved in actually figuring out what the actual motion is. So, in the New Astronomy, Kepler... In the New Astronomy, Kepler actually does discover the relationships of the distance, the planet's distance from the Sun, to its speed, within one orbit. And... So, I'll show you something first. Okay, I gotta pull this up here. Okay. Okay, so this is just kind of a simple thing. Cover up the picture. This is kind of a simple thing. Showing...
Can you move?
I don't know, put it off in it. Ah! God. Okay, we're gonna leave that. Okay, so this is kind of a series. This is just to show you the planet has different speeds on the orbit. So this one, the planet is traveling the same speed the whole time, which would be the speed that it would have to go in order to complete its circuit in 1 year. Or, like the Earth, if the Earth traveled the same speed the whole time around its orbit, it would be going this speed to complete its orbit within 365 days. But the planets don't stay the same speed all the time, they change. So you have it going fastest when it's closest to the Sun and then slowing down. And then there you see the what he calls the mean motion, the same motion, compared to the changing motion. So you see that right here, they complete their orbit at the same time. But there's change in between. I guess it's right over there.
Does that explain what he's seeing in the stars?
Oh, with that loop?
Yeah.
Nope. No. That's another story. Sorry, it's lost my... So what Kepler proves in the New Astronomy is that the relationship of the planet, the relationship of the speed of the planet at two different points on its orbit is equal to the inverse of the distance. So that the relationship of the speed of the planet at two different points, for example, the speed at perihelion to the mean motion, that relationship is just simply the inverse of the relationship of their distances. Because if the planet's closer to the sun, it's moving faster. If it's further away, it's moving slower. So, I mean, we could say, like, if we said this was 1 and this was 3, then the planet would be moving 3 times faster here than it's moving here.
So the distance is 1/3.
Yeah, if the distance is 1/3, the speed is 3 times. Triple. And he proves this. I'm not sure if this was known before the New Astronomy, actually. I actually don't know. I want to say it wasn't. I want to say he was the first one to discover it. This is actually all coming out of his hypothesis about the sun being the mover and universal gravitation being the power that's sweeping the planet along. So he discovers this relationship. Now, in the Harmony, when he's examining and comparing different relationships or different planetary orbits, what he finds is that if you have two planets now that are at two different distances, that relationship for their speeds does not hold.
Changes?
It changes. Like if Earth was, you know, half the distance away from the sun as Mars, Earth would not be going twice the speed. It would be doing something different. This is a huge paradox throughout his whole life. It really bothered him. Yeah. That even though, I'll use the 3 again, even though here this is 1/3 of the distance of this,
mm-hmm.
It's going 3 times the speed. If instead of one planet, if this were two different planets, like let's say Earth was here and Mars was here, their speed relationship would not be 1/3.
So, and it works for which one?
If this is just a single planet,
okay, yeah.
Single planetary orbit, that speed relationship I was talking about is true.
Okay.
That the planet here will be going 3 times the speed of the planet there, if its distance is 1/3.
Mm-hmm.
But if this were two different planets, Earth and Mars, that would not be true. Even though it's the exact same distances from the sun, the speed relationship would be different.
You mean if their orbits were like superimposed upon each other?
Yeah, I actually have an animation of something like that. But even if they were different, like if you had the Earth's orbit like this, something, and the Mars orbit like that, outside of it, that's not the relationship of the speeds and distances of two different planets, even though it is for a single planet within its orbit.
How did he, this single planet, ratio, how did he come up with that? If the system has multiple planets and it doesn't hold true?
Well, in the New Astronomy, he was trying to fetter Mars. He was trying to contain Mars and figure it out. So in the work, the New Astronomy, that all of our offices are in the middle of working through now, he's dealing with a single planet's relationship to the sun. And it's during the course of that he uncovers this relationship. But it's not until the Harmony, or at least his work leading up to the Harmony, that he is confronted with the fact that that's not true when you start to compare different planets. And he's got to figure that out. Mm-hmm.
I'm actually having a hard time understanding this. If the sun is where the sun is right now,
mm-hmm.
and a planet, whichever planet that is like orbiting the sun, then the inverse law holds, you're saying?
Yes.
1/3 distance, 1/3 speed.
Mm-hmm. 1/3 of the distance, 3 times the speed.
At that point.
Mm-hmm.
1/6 the distance elsewhere.
6
times.
6
the speed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So he discovers that proportion holds for sun and a planet.
Yeah, if you're comparing a planet to itself. Because what you're doing is you're comparing a planet when it's at a different position in its own orbit.
On its own orbit.
See what I mean?
Okay, but is sun in the center?
Mm-hmm.
The system?
Yeah.
Okay. But then when he compares Slash off. Sorry. But then, so where doesn't it fit? When he,
when you're comparing not the same planet at different positions on its orbit, but when you're comparing two different planets. When you take
hold.
It doesn't hold. If instead of this being one planet's orbit, if you had two orbits here, one of Earth like this, and one of Mars that came up like this, something like that, and you said this is the distance of Mars from the Sun at this moment, and this is the distance of Earth from the Sun at this moment, and this is one third, the speed relationship would not be 3:1.
Okay, so let's say this is Mars, and we put another orbit
mm-hmm.
around,
mm-hmm.
and we say Jupiter,
mm-hmm.
and we pick a line, a point,
mm-hmm.
and that's like one third, let's say, of Mars, and it's one something of the Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
That this lot doesn't hold.
Nope.
Oh, okay.
Nope, it doesn't hold. And I'll just show you a kind of a fun animation that my friend Rihanna made. Kind of looks wacky, but what it is you have the green orbit, it would be Jupiter, the larger orbit. The smaller orbit would be Mars. And this weird, really wacky orbit is one she just made up, that whose closest distance is the distance of Mars, and its furthest distance is the distance of Jupiter. And I couldn't find the file, but there's one on the, I think there's one on the website, or it should be there. I couldn't find it, but what she did is she actually has sound files so that you can hear the harmonies of these different points. So you can hear that the fake planet, when it's here, is not singing the same note as Mars when it's here,
mm-hmm.
meaning it's not going the same speed,
huh.
even though it is the same distance from the Sun.
Oh.
It's pretty cool. And she took the real data from Mars and Jupiter, and then calculated, using all the laws that Kepler proved, calculated what this planet's motion would be if it did exist.
Are these all based on the fact that there's a hypothesis that any planet will be at a certain speed depending on how close it is to the Sun?
Well, that's the hypothesis. However, it doesn't seem to be true all the time.
No.
Because if it's a different planet at the same distance, it's not going the same speed.
So that's just something you tried out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he actually, I'm not going to go through it tonight, but he actually did discover what the relationship is. And
why don't you want to see it?
It takes
Are you depriving us of knowledge?
You're making us hang it.
Read the book now. So he actually did discover the relationship. But I'll tell you something interesting. He discovered the relationship of the motion to the distance, but he had to do it from the standpoint of, like, instead of taking the motion at just the moment, like we were talking about, he took the entire time that it would take the planet to go around the orbit. So like one Earth year, and then one Mars year, which is motion. It's the motion. It's just one long motion. And he had to do it from that standpoint. So he discovered the relationship between those two entire motions to the distances of the planets. And that relationship holds only when the planet is traveling the mean motion. Only when the planet is at the point on its orbit where it's traveling the average speed. Any other point on that orbit, it doesn't quite with what he discovered. It's changing all the time. The planet is constantly changing. And he was never able to quite hone in on exactly what that relationship would be at every single moment, since he's constantly changing his relationship. So, if you think about that, you have a planet where certain knowledge that you had about distance to speed relationships broke down. And then, after all this work, and he describes in the book this miraculous moment when he figured out the distance to speed relationship of two planets, it holds, but not at every point in the orbit.
It's not between the distance of the Sun and the planet, but the distance, the section of the orbit of the planet who makes the...
Oh, you're talking about the amount of arc?
Yeah.
Well, that's how he measured speed, Right. He didn't measure it in velocity, like miles per kilometers per hour. He didn't measure the absolute velocity. He measured it as if you were sitting on the sun, or if you were the sun, and you were looking at what you're moving, because you're causing that thing to go. If you were looking at what you're moving, you would judge the motion. You know, in a day it goes that much. So he took his speed measurements were in angles. Mm-hmm. Right. So with this thing, you have something which is absolutely constantly changing. And it seems as if every step he takes closer to it, it still eludes him. But that's why he stuck to Axiom 1, if you guys remember it. Which was this. It is fitting that in any place whatever, where it could be so, between the extreme motions both of individual planets and of pairs, harmonies ought to have been established of all kinds so that such variety should adorn the world. And this is what guided him the entire time. So what he did is, instead of trying to calculate the exact motion of the planet at that moment, what he did is he took, or instead of trying to calculate the relationships between the planets at the extreme moments which eluded him, he instead took the observational data, which told him the speeds, and he sought the harmonies there. And he found them. He actually found them.
Okay, it's kind of a dark, it's a photograph, it's kind of dark. But, can you guys see that? Kind of. This is a similar chart to the one I showed you for the distances. But instead of the distances, he looks at the size of the motion, or for him, this is how he's measuring the speed of the planet, at the fastest speed and the slowest speed, as the sun would see it, as the mover would perceive it. And he goes through every single planet, and the English edition has mistakes in it, that's why these are crossed out. But what he finds is four to five to be the relationship of the two fastest and slowest speeds of Saturn, almost perfectly. He finds five to six, almost perfectly, to be the proportion between Jupiter's two motions. Two to three is the proportion between Mars's two extreme motions. 15 to 16, which is a half step, it's a very small interval, almost perfectly, is Earth's proportion. 24 to 25, which
Earth
is actually
four?
Earth with itself, its fastest and its slowest speed. Venus is 24 to 25, which is a very small, imperfect interval. But he also he discovers the reason for that, which I don't have time to get into tonight. And Mercury is 5 to 12, which is actually a very large interval, almost perfectly. And these are all tones which you guys heard in those two musical scales, which I played. These would all represent tones. Yeah, I can show you the... He made scales. He made, like, you know, staffs with these planets as notes on them.
I'm sorry?
Oh, I'll show you.
That wasn't my question.
What's your question?
The first set of groups that he compared with, they weren't harmonious. What were those? The distances?
The distances.
And the second was the speed.
Mm-hmm.
And those were harmonious.
Yeah, they're almost perfect. Yeah.
It does. Isn't distance a component of speed?
It's related, huh?
But why wouldn't it hold true for distance then?
You should play with it. It does have to do with what I was talking about, with this very strange relationship between distance and motions when you're comparing many different orbits. It's something to look at. So it's specifically in book 5 of the Harmony. So this is actually the same, it's pretty much the same chart.
same chart, but what you can see here is he not only looked at Saturn's own proportion between its two motions, but he compared the fastest speed of Saturn with the slowest speed of Jupiter, which is this. And he found that they form a perfect octave.
The what? Sorry.
The fastest speed of Saturn, which is 135.
When it says convert, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
the slowest speed of Jupiter, which is 270, which is exactly twice Saturn, so it forms a perfect octave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just one pass quickly.
Yeah.
The converted to
seconds
with actual intervals.
What is that?
Yeah.
It's a degree of arc.
Okay.
Is made up of 60 minutes, and each of those minutes is made up of 60 seconds. So in one day, Saturn moves 106 seconds, or 106 3,600ths of a degree. So he found that not only are the planets harmonic with themselves, but they're also harmonic with their neighbors. And any of the intervals that didn't, or almost all the intervals of our musical scale that you heard that we didn't find with a single planet, you find them between planets.
If we would measure the speed of the planet right now with the cutting-edge measuring instruments, would we get the same results? Because it has been measured in this 16th century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do. It's very accurate. Yeah. Just one caution that you I had a lot of fun. I just went to NASA's website and did it, got all the data, and I had a lot of fun doing it. But I got really frustrated because at first I made the mistake of taking the velocity as the same thing as what he's doing, and it's not. Like velocity, if you say like 17 kilometers a second, what that implies really is a distance. That's like a distance along a track, you know? But what he's looking at is exactly what Jalal said. He's looking at the angle as the sun would perceive it. So this, like when you're making astronomical observations, you can't look at a planet and know how fast it's going. You actually have to take an angular measurement. You know, last week it was here, now it's here, it's moved 5 degrees.
Not degrees, not distance.
Right, that's how you have to take astronomical observations. It's also how the sun takes astronomical observations when it moves the planet.
So
it's the same thing.
Angular velocity.
Angular velocity, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Plus the distance doesn't denote the arc, right? This is, when you think distance, you think straight line.
Well, you have a distance of the planet from the sun, which is as if taking a straight line.
Oh.
But then you have a distance along a curved path.
Mm-hmm.
It's curved orbit. Where every second it goes 17 point something kilometers. Approximately. Right, so he found harmony everywhere amongst the motions of the planets. Absolutely everywhere. Almost. I'll get to that. And he constructed the music system out of them.
Is that the Earth that moves 17 kilometers?
Oh, I forget which one. They all move extremely fast.
Yeah, that's...
I forget which one of them moves... I think that's one of the asteroids that moves like 17.6 kilometers every second. It's really fast, yeah. Sorry, I just had to pull up these charts on the website.
I forget, what interval is Earth, or were you not there yet?
15/16, which is a semitone, or a half set.
Can we listen to that?
I don't have a recording. If there's one on the website somewhere. I don't have one just ready to go. Yeah, Earth and Venus make the smallest intervals.
Half a step is like a sharp or a flat note.
Mm-hmm. It'd be like...
Yeah. I think it's mi to fa, isn't it?
Yeah, mi to fa. Mm-hmm. That's one example. Okay. So, these are from the book. Kepler just kind of wrote out each planet, like, he wrote out what each planet sings, kind of. because Saturn would sing a major third, like sol, la, si, la, sol, over the course of its orbit. Or more like sol, something like that.
Mm.
So from the... What? And the moon comes around to it too.
Not as good as the giant boy can do it.
Oh, wait. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Okay, so he, there we go.
Which is the highest point?
Mercury.
No, I mean, close to the sun? Or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, wait, the highest note?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The one with the fastest motion. That's the one closest to the sun. So what he did is he started with Saturn's aphelion, which is the slowest motion that he knew about. And what he did is he figured out, okay, what would 3/4, or since you're dealing with speeds, which are getting faster, 4/3, proportion of 4 to 3, what would 4/3 of Saturn's motion be? Well, it would be the motion of Mars at perihelion, which is 143. I think it's actually 142 seconds, if you want to be precise. Mars's motion is 143. So if Saturn sings the note G or Sol, Mars would sing the note Do or C,
it's at that point.
Point. At its perihelion.
What if it's not there when Saturn's at its aphelion?
Well, then they wouldn't sing the notes at the same time.
Okay.
But if you think about the entire system, if you think about
okay.
an entire composed, constructed system,
mm-hmm.
these are the boundaries of the motions.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're right. Like in between these fastest and slowest motions, you have all these like in between intervals. But if the things are actually bounded by harmonies.
Yeah.
So this scale here is the major scale, which you guys heard before is the major scale. What?
That Saturn's at the helion and Mars is perihelion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If Saturn is singing the note G, then you ask yourself what the note C. Do would be the three to four proportion on the string. So if you take the 3 to 4 proportion of 106 seconds, which is Saturn's motion, you'd get 142, I think. And Mars's motion of perihelion is 143 seconds, which is, the difference is negligible. Negligible.
Okay, so that represents...
That's Mars. So Mars at perihelion sings the note Do. Perfectly, pretty much. And you see that the planet's motions actually participate in the major scale, in every single note of a major scale, except for the second note, which no planet's motion corresponds to. It's a hole in the system. but just so remember, so you have every note except for the second one. But then he shows that if you build the soft melody or the minor scale on Saturn's perihelion, then the planet's motions fill up every slot except for the seventh. Nope. Huh. Mm-hmm. But the second one, which we didn't have before, is filled.
We lost the seventh.
But we have the second.
It's kind of like the inverse, though.
A little bit, yeah. It is the inverse. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Kepler finds that both the major and the minor scale were composed into the motions of the heavens, despite all of this irregular, seemingly unknowable change. So actually I want to play something for you guys. It's about 5 minutes long, but I want you to think about this because he, think about the implications of, oh, yes.
Does the expansion of the universe has an effect on the proportion?
Hasn't so far. Hasn't in 400 years. But also, I mean, I'll see if I can answer that question over the rest of what I say, because I have some thoughts about that. But I'll get to it. And if it's not answered by the end, you can ask it again.
Can you just repeat, because I don't get the inverse one, the seventh disappearing
mm-hmm.
and the second reappearing.
Yeah, just that when Kepler, he took the proportions that he knew about from what we were looking at with the music, the proportions of 3 to 4, 2 to 3, And we've gone through it quickly, but we found that they actually make notes of the major and the minor scales. If you have strings which are cut in these lines, vibrating strings. Is that clear?
You take a string, you divide it,
yeah,
and the sounds that they make,
mm-hmm,
you split major, minor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and he relates that to the planets somehow?
He doesn't just relate it, he discovers it in the planetary motion.
Okay.
He discovers the same proportions that formed the major and the minor scale exist between the motions of the planets. Very precisely.
Okay.
Could you say that again? I just want to write
that. Yeah, that the same proportions that formed the major and the minor scale, he discovered them in the motions of the planets. That the motions of the planets form the same proportions, very precisely.
The proportions of their fastest speed and their lowest speed? Or?
Yeah, their extremes. Because you have all this variance in between, but you have the two extreme motions which are bounding the orbit, where the planet accelerates until it reaches its fastest speed, and it begins to slow down until it reaches its slowest, and then it speeds up again.
So that's how he creates two-thirds, four-fifths, taking the highest speed,
mm-hmm,
and the lowest speed?
Yeah.
Okay, which was which? The fastest is major or minor?
They're mixed. Like, if you look here, the major scale, the hard scale, it has both aphelions, which is the slowest.
Okay.
It also has some perihelions in it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
When is Saturn at aphelion? It's Saturn at aphelion speed over the speed at mean position?
Which?
Because if there is aphelion and perihelion,
yeah,
with which magnitude, which speed is the proportion?
Well, there are many proportions involved with each planet. Saturn has a proportion with itself, with its own slowest and fastest, which is 4 to 5. So that's why, like, see here, you have here Saturn and aphelion, and Saturn and perihelion makes this interval. But Saturn and aphelion also makes an interval with Mars, the perihelion, the perfect harmonic interval. And that proportion is 3 to 4. Mm-hmm. So when I was going through this, I had to really think about the implications of the musical systems existing in the heavens, because just from knowing a little bit about what human beings have done with the musical system here on Earth, because you don't just have, like, people don't just run around singing major and minor scales, right? We have musical composition, which is kind of the point. It's kind of the point of having these musical tones. So I wanted to actually play something for you. It's about 5 minutes long, but I wanted you to hear it. And when you're listening to it, kind of be thinking about and ask yourself, what are the implications of having the same musical system that is the cause or makes this possible, makes what you're hearing possible? What are the implications of having that in the solar system? What does that mean about what kind of universe you're living in?
Thank you.
was Beethoven's choral fantasy, the third movement. So, yeah, I think it's a pretty provocative question when you think of if man was given a certain musical system and through the development of culture was able to produce something as beautiful as that, were you going to say that God wasn't able to do that or something? Or man was able to create something more beautiful than God, better than God, better than the Creator? So it just raises the question about what is the potential nature of the solar system? So I want to throw in a little wrench into the works, though, because there's not quite everything in the solar system is perfectly harmonic. And this was kind of fun, because there's something that really bothered Kepler ever since he was a very young man. And I know the Greeks noticed it. I don't know how much, but they noticed it. There's a really big gap in between Mars and Jupiter. It's very big. I don't know, like, maybe you guys want to look at that later. I was just looking at that. Petros, you can see it. That blue strip at the bottom of the poster, if people want to look at it later, shows the planetary distances. Like, all the inner planets are maybe, like, you know, this close to one another. You have, like, Mercury to Mars, and then you have Jupiter, like, way out here. And it's very anomalous that you have a certain, you know, geometrical progression of the distances, and then Jupiter's just way out there. And it really bothered Kepler. And actually, when Kepler's reflecting back on what he found with the harmonies, and he's looking, he just takes a look at the discrepancies between the observations and what a perfect interval would be, and they're all extremely accurate, except for Jupiter and Mars. And the harmonies there, they're harmonic, but they're a little bit more off than the rest. So he knows that there's something going on there. And he kind of leaves it there. He doesn't pursue it. But Carl Friedrich Gauss actually makes a discovery about something that does lie there. And the first thing that we, for positive, filled up that space between Jupiter and Mars was the asteroid Ceres, which Gauss, it was observed in 1801, I believe. New Year's Day, 1801, by Piazzi. And Carl Gauss, as a young man as well, I'm pretty sure, was the first one to actually be able to determine what it was. And everybody else was totally wrong. And he was right on as to what the thing was and where it was going to next be seen in the sky. And that's what the current team, actually, the current, that's not a Kepler team, but the current team working out of LaRouche's basement is working on this problem. And they're going to put out a report in a few months on that. So I just wanted to look. I did a little bit of work because I was extremely curious about this thing. Have you guys ever looked at some of the thing, like some of these asteroids and what they are, what they look like? They're very weird.
What are asteroids, by the way?
I will show you. This is an asteroid. No, this is a video.
How did we get that?
we sent a probe that landed on this asteroid in 2001. This asteroid is called Eros, and it's a near-Earth asteroid. I don't know exactly what that means. Maybe it's closer than others, but this is a full rotation of Eros. It's kind of, I mean, the Earth spins, right, in one day. We spin. Eros also spins, but it's so funny-shaped that it looks really weird.
Doesn't it look too big?
I'll show you. I have no idea how big it is, relatively speaking. I'll show you another picture of it so you can see. There you go. That's Eros. It's really weird. And this is Eros from a distance. You can kind of, this is a rotation of Eros from a distance, but you can kind of get a sense of the shape of the thing. And then this is the probe. It's called Schumacher, near Schumacher. That we sent up there, it landed on it.
How big was it?
How big was it? The probe?
No,
the asteroid? Eros. I don't know. So the question in my mind was, okay, why the hell is the space between Jupiter and Mars filled with literally thousands of things like that, kind of all flying around there, thousands of them, instead of a planet? I mean, if you're going to put anything there at all, why not a planet? Why would you choose to put a bunch of those things? It blew up. How do you know?
I said maybe.
Oh.
Something
blew up. The
asteroids?
Yeah. I don't really know. I looked at, I'll show you briefly, I looked at three of them, three of the biggest ones. And they do have a certain order to them, but if you visually look at like how we've mapped the orbits of the asteroids that we know about so far, they're really wacky. They don't seem to have any, they cross each other. They're not concentric like the orbits of the planets. They cross each other's path. The comets flying in and out, you know. They're really weird.
I know, I heard some astronomers talking about the asteroid belt acting as a shield.
A shield?
For the Earth, to protect it from outside comets and stuff that might be threatening.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting idea.
What's like the difference between what's a comet, what's an asteroid, what's a meteor?
I don't know. Okay, well, I know a comet. I don't know a lot about these things, but I do know is that,
ice.
Yeah, they have a different composition. Well, some of the asteroids are made of ice too. Ceres is about 1/4 ice, I think. But
well, things that come into Earth's atmosphere are meteors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, little chunks of these things
yeah.
that are either left, maybe left out there, and as we rotate, they enter the atmosphere. Are meteors. I don't know exactly the classification difference between an asteroid and comets, but comets, I don't think they have like a regular closed orbit. They tend to like fly in and then fly way back out, and they have really long, strange orbits.
So essentially, it's what size and composition that differentiates them?
I don't know.
What they do.
Is it on a plane, like the asteroid field? It's on a plane. It's
It's not a sphere. It's kind of like a plane, but they're all every asteroid's kind of on a different plane.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, I have a little diagram of the three asteroids that I looked at for you to see. If I can find them.
And how many years later was this that Gauss discover this?
After Kepler? It was 1801, and Kepler was 1619.
Kepler hypothesized that something was there?
He hypothesized that there was something weird going on. And he, I have a quote if you want to hear it. When he was looking at the Mysterium, in the Mysterium, in the introduction, he talks about how when he was just trying to figure out the distances, not the motions, he hypothesized that there might be a missing planet in between Jupiter and Mars. But he was looking at it purely from the standpoint of distance, but it's an interesting idea. He thought this space is so big, maybe it's filled by a planet that's just too small to see with the naked eye. Or by our observational method. So he had a hypothetical planet that he put there, and he figured out kind of like we did. He figured out like fake orbital characteristics for it, and it still didn't really fit any system. He said having one planet in between Jupiter and Mars wasn't enough to make like an order between the distances of the planets, but he couldn't figure out how to fit two planets in there to make an order either, so he kind of gave up on that idea. Yeah. Yeah, let me see if I can find this diagram. Here we go. This is kind of just a rough diagram of the three asteroids that I looked at, which are Ceres, Pallas, and Vesta. And Ceres and Vesta, their orbits cross each other. They're very similar orbits, but they cross each other, and they're on slightly different inclinations or tilts. And Pallas is just wacky. It's huge. It's very inclined. It's very much inclined. Mm-hmm. It's very eccentric, meaning it's very much like it very much differs from a circle, much more than the other two. Okay, so despite the really strange composition of the orbits, the asteroids, the look of them, they're very different than anything else out there that we've looked at so far. Despite all that, what I did is I just had some fun looking at. I took the data for these three asteroids, and I just compared it as if Kepler, as Kepler would have. I just kind of asked what are its harmonic relationships to its neighbors. And I wanted to see if they had, maybe my hypothesis was that maybe they had a really strange harmonic relationship to their neighbors. Or maybe, I don't know, must be something strange going on here. Maybe there's a dissonance in this spot. Maybe it was impossible. There had to be a reason why there's not a harmonic normal, as we would know it, a normal planet there. So, I first compared, oh god, you can't see the table, huh? Okay. Jupiter. And just like Kepler made Saturn the bottom node of the scale, I made Jupiter the bottom node of the scale. And I figured out what, if this is the motion of Jupiter, and this is just in relative units, if this is the motion of Jupiter, I just calculated what the perfect value for the tones of the musical scale would be. And then what I did is I looked at the data, and I looked to see if any of the planets fit in. And what I found is that not only do some planets fit in, like Mercury and Venus, but also the asteroids actually fit into the scale if you build a scale on Mars, on Jupiter. So for example, in the major scale built on Jupiter, Vesta, the asteroid, is almost perfectly precisely the node D. It's aphelion. And the same thing with the minor scale. That if you build the minor scale on Jupiter, the asteroids actually fall into the scale.
Is the comma same thing as meant to be commas in music?
Well, Kepler has a very specific value for what he calls a comma. It's an interval of 80 to 81 on the string. If you cut a string into 81 parts and then played 80 of them, that interval is very, very, very small.
What does that say?
That's what he calls a comma. You have the name comma. That's what I refer to by half a comma, 1.5 commas. That's how far off the planet's value is from the ideal value. And I also did it for Mars. So you can see that the asteroids also correspond to the major and the minor scale if you build it on Mars. And actually, of these three asteroids, all of their extreme motions can be accounted for by these four scales. They fit. And they're much less harmonic with the other planets. Like I compare them to all of the planets up to Saturn. And occasionally they'll be harmonic, but not very often. So I was pretty confused as to why they made harmonies, but they're still asteroids rather than a planet. So what I did is I then asked, well, if they make these particular harmonies with their neighbors, what does that mean about the harmonies they make with themselves? So what interval does the asteroid series sing with itself? And I want you to hear that. Okay. So you guys remember what they looked like? Ceres and Vesta were the two that crossed each other. They were similar, and then Pallas was the wacky one. So first, Ceres. Yeah, it's the most harmonic.
Yeah, I know I missed, but can you just go quickly on the... since it's the perihelion and the aphelion, we heard two notes.
Mm-hmm.
So is it like the difference, the distance from the speed itself?
It's the speed at that moment.
Speed?
Mm-hmm. That's the proportion of the speed. The motion. Yeah. So Ceres and Vesta sing a very strange interval, but Pallas, which is the wackiest physically, is actually the most harmonic with itself. Which is very weird.
That begs the question, why?
I know. It's okay, actually. Don't worry about it. I don't know. I can't answer it in Canada. Okay. Oh, can you come help me now? Do you have a question?
Yeah, but Do you have an idea about how to manage your asteroid belt?
The whole thing?
Yeah.
No. Well, I have some ideas. I'm not quite sure. I mean, there's one choice you have to look at every single asteroid, but that takes you a long time.
Because when Gauss discovered it, was he aware of Kepler?
Yeah. Of course. That's actually how he discovered it. At least that's according to LaRouche. I've never worked through the Gauss, but LaRouche, the reason we're the youth movement is taking on Gauss as the third in this series of projects is because Gauss used Kepler's discovery to make his discovery. His discovery of the orbit of Ceres was actually a proof of Kepler's principles. So, just briefly, I know it's getting a little bit late, but just briefly, I wanted to... you guys heard that there's dissonance, right? These are the only bodies that we've looked at so far that are dissonant with themselves. And then the question comes up, well, you know, we have a musical system, which happens to be planetary, celestial. We have a musical system which has dissonance in it. So, okay, well, what use or what purpose does dissonance have in musical composition, in classical composition?
Irony.
What? Irony. Well, we're going to just... You have a strange look on your face. We're going to demonstrate something. See if you can, see if you can hear.
I have this on your face.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have like a perfect answer to the question, but I do know from the choral work we're doing, especially on Bach, I do know that composers actually sometimes choose dissonance in a composition. Actually choose to have dissonance. So we're just going to demonstrate one instance of that in the part of the motet that our chorus is working on, Jesu meine Freude. It's just a little tiny part from the center, the Ihr aber seid fleischlich. But I'll put up the words for it so you know what we're singing.
Is it just the beginning?
Yeah, just the alto and then the soprano.
Okay.
Remember what I did with Tirana?
Yeah.
What is this? Okay, we're just going to sing a little... I'm just going to demonstrate an instance where a composer uses a dissonance in a composition. And
which,
we're going to...
Which voice is this?
We're just going to sing a small part of the alto voice and the soprano voice.
Which one? Which one?
We'll hear it. From this piece. Actually,
I mean, which soprano?
First soprano. Does anybody speak German here?
Nine.
Is that all you speak, or do you speak?
No, that's it.
Okay. You'll have to... then nobody knows how bad my German is. Good. So, the words in German are, Ihr aber seid nicht fleischlich, sondern geistlich. Which means, you are not of the flesh, but of the spirit. So anders Gottes Geist in euch wohnet. If so be, that God's spirit dwells in you. Wer aber Christi Geist nicht hat, der ist nicht sein. Whoever does not have Christ's spirits, he is none of his. So we're just going to, the part we're going to demonstrate before I let you hear the whole piece so you get an idea of the context of the dissonance, we're just going to be singing the first two lines. And what you'll hear is you'll hear, maybe we can sing the melody together. We'll sing the melody together, which is just this much. You are not of the flesh, but of the spirit. And then what we'll do is we'll sing the two parts that I want to demonstrate together and see if you can hear on what part the dissonance arises.
So?
Yeah, just the
starting line. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Ihr aber seid nicht fleischlich, sondern geistlich, sondern geistlich.
Mm-hmm. So that's the statement, the musical statement. Okay. Do you want to sing the alto or soprano?
Doesn't
matter. Alto?
Okay.
Okay. Can we just pause or really emphasize that part?
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Start on the
okay.
Yeah. Okay. Ihr aber seid nicht fleischlich, sondern geistlich, sondern
geistlich. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Let's do it again.
Yeah, sure. Ihr aber seid nicht fleißig, sondern geist. Ihr aber seid nicht fleißig.
I don't know if you guys could hear it
again.
You want to just the end part?
Again. Yeah, mm-hmm. Sure.
You can start from the song.
Okay. Can I do it from the beginning? Because I don't know if I remember that. That's fine.
Mm-hmm. Sounds pretty good, actually.
Yeah, there is a dissonance, though. Right, I mean, Bach isn't one, I mean, the dissonance isn't always, like, painful, right? But there's tension. There's tension in the line.
Are you not?
Well, I'm going to play the whole thing.
Okay.
But, right, so do you guys hear where the tension between the two voices was? On what, words?
What word,
it would
guys?
Be not.
On the word
Fleischli?
Yeah, well, I was singing Fleisch,
oh.
And she was singing Geist.
Oh.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. I mean, that's not like the end-all, be-all of the whole composition, but but it's you know, it gives you a sense of how, given a certain idea that you'd want to communicate to people, you know, dissonance can actually be very necessary. It can be
they
very necessary.
Did they do it for tension purposes, like you said?
Well,
to create.
Well, I think.
I think you're in tension because of the subjects and the poetry.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to assign such a literal thing to his, because he doesn't. Bach doesn't just always like every time you hear Fleisch and Geist, it's not always dissonant. Right,
but
it's not
in the context of what you're saying here, it does make sense.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this is the opening, right? Where you only have two, and actually at this point, three voices. There's a tenor voice that's singing, too. So it's very exposed, and so this he's able to bring this out and develop it. So I want to play just this short little piece of the whole motet, of this motet for you. Because what composers like Bach will do is they'll actually take a dissonance, which is certainly a dissonance from your current state of mind, when you enter into this piece and you hear you're not of the flesh, you're of the spirit, and you're in a certain state of mind. But throughout the course of the entire composition, this tension, which was a tension at first, is actually worked out by the composer. And so you actually have something which is brought to a beautiful resolution, not only in notes, but an idea. So I'm just going to play it so you guys can hear, get a sense of it.
Thank you.
commenting on some of this.
Well, you have to have a, often in solving a problem, go outside the problem as stated and find the solution outside the problem as stated. It's the typical scientific method, always. Because if you have a problem and you have people who are reasonably expert in a certain area, you generally find they are expert in that area. They've done a lot of, they've explored a lot of things. If they have a lot of colleagues with whom they discuss these things, they've gone through it rather thoroughly. And if they don't find, if they don't have a solution to a problem within the area of their expertise, go outside the area of their expertise and find the solution. Because the problem is they haven't gone far enough. It's like the idea of creation. You see, creation, man is creation, creative, and God is creative, is the idea that the universe is constantly changing, it's expanding. It's expanding by going outside itself. I'll take, give you an example of this, because it may come up in other questions. Let's take the case of the sun. Now, a long, long time ago, by our standards, the sun was out there all by itself in its particular area, all alone. And it was spinning. It was spinning probably because it was, you know, fidgety and youthful, didn't know what to do with itself, just spinning, spinning wildly. So it began to spin off material, plasma. It would spill it off in the form naturally of a disk. You know, this kind of rotation, you see this one? A disk. Now this disk was being hit by radiation from the sun. And my conjecture was, and the major laboratory pointed this out to me, so I was right, polarized radiation would produce what we used to call the 98-2-element periodic table in the solar system. And also, it would distill this product, just like fractional distillation, but not quite. Then you have this work by Kepler, who went through this, and people didn't really study Kepler enough to understand him, because he had two things. Not only did he discover gravitation, but by the same method he extended that to the dynamics of the whole system in his idea of harmonics. So this was a trick, of course, as Charles can explain to people, about how he discovered the orbit of Ceres and Pallas, is by on the basis of Keplerian harmonics, by recognizing that the characteristical thing in the Kepler system would have to fit in a certain harmonic belt. Then out, boom! Came into place. But look what happened. The solar system is out there, the sun's out there, and you get a solar system. You get a development from the sun, in the sun, which is outside the sun. Then you start looking at galaxies and so forth and say, hey, this universe is not organized the way these teachers tell us. The universe is created. Is derived, driven by creative principles of creating higher orders of organization than it itself represents. And that's the way man should think about man. People who are stagnant don't do too well. Now,
so, in doing this work, you start to get a sense that the universe is going somewhere, that it's not breaking down, and it's not becoming entropic. And you start to get a sense of this because when you reflect on how Kepler actually made his discoveries. First of all, the fact that the solar system is not just randomly flying around out there, whacking into things, right? Planets aren't just whacking into one another, but it's organized. And you realize at a certain, I mean, at a certain point, many, many moons ago, the planets weren't there. Right, but you've had a process of these, our solar system becoming more organized, more perfect. It has a directionality. And when you reflect on how Kepler made this discovery, it wasn't through taking mountains of observations and hoping for divine inspiration. What did he do? He went back and he looked at what man's mind could know. And he looked at what's made available to man, on, you know, here on Earth, sitting here on Earth. What principles are made available to man in his process of transforming and improving society and the planet, and in bringing beauty to human culture. And that's how he, that was the pathway by which he made his discovery. then you ask yourself, well, what kind of creator and what kind of universe are we dealing with, if that's the case? And what role do we play in that universe? Because the solar system exhibits the same principles of creativity as mankind, in a sense. So, I mean, the time has really come where the human species has got to stop thinking of itself as animals, and actually truly assume a powerful role of continuing the development of the solar system. And that's got to start with fighting the political fight we're fighting right now, which is to impeach the United States Vice President, to send the United States President out of office immediately, and to get the kind of economic policies in place that Lyndon LaRouche is talking about. You know, an isotope economy where mankind stops just mining, consuming the elements of the planet, the natural resources, but we actually participate in creating new raw materials that didn't exist before. We actually manufacture and create the raw materials that we need to bring the human species, all 6.5 billion and more of us, up to a level of having a living standard where everybody has the freedom to make discoveries like this and accelerate the process. And that's really what this political fight is about. I mean, it's not about, you know, being in some perpetual state of angst and protesting against some war for the rest of your life or something, right? But it's actually and truly assuming an adult human role for the human species and playing the role that we're destined to play in the development of the solar system. And when you start to think of your life in that context, it begins to organize the decisions that you make today in what you do with your life. And that is what LaRouche's youth movement is striving for and doing. And that's why we have weekend events like this. And we're having another one in Boston on the 3rd, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. And right after that, we're going down to Washington, D.C. to bring these ideas to the United States Congress, because they have to impeach Dick Cheney, but they also have to know what to do. And it's our job to truly bring in a renaissance by reviving principles that haven't existed on this planet in 400 years, and ones that have never existed yet in all of mankind's history. So, what? In Boston? Tomorrow? Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody should come. Oh, that's the point. Yeah, yeah, people should come down with us. That's the point. People can come from here. I assume that you guys are driving down Claire Cowdery School and continuing to Washington.
When is it? Sorry?
March 2nd, 3rd, and 4th is the Boston Cowdery School, and then we're immediately heading from there on probably Monday morning down to Washington for a week. So, that's it, unless people have questions.
Michelle's going to kick off the day. I'm not positive after. We're going to sing in the morning, that's for sure. I don't know what time exactly Michelle wants to start. I think around 10.
Matt?
Yeah?
To start around 9, to get to leave around noon.
Oh, so we're starting the classes right away then? Yeah?
Not all.
Okay. Well, there you go. Huh?
Your class after
that? Yeah, I'm gonna jump in afterwards. But Michelle's going to give hers on the development plans built up for the Eurasian area. And really just actually change the whole structure of physical economy, the physical setting of Eurasia, so it becomes something a little bit more applying to our potential. And then I'm going to give a little something on a problem that we've dealt with already, and how Roosevelt dealt with certain problems that we're facing today. That's going to be in the afternoon. So you should all? Yeah.
We're also going to have a music.
Afterwards?
I think from tonight you can get a sense of what a real culture would be about, as opposed to, this is kind of like the resolution of the dissonance which Val and I presented earlier today. Yeah, seriously. But this is just it, and all these, when you talk to all these groups out there, there's one of our people down in Leesburg was giving an update yesterday, and I just happened to catch a little bit. He was saying, out there right now, all the different social groups that are trying to battle this stuff, they're all these groups, whether it's the unions or whatnot, organized popular movements, are all either in major crisis or falling apart, and we're the only movement that is growing. And, it was like this for the organization also back in the early 70s when the whole socialist movement in the States was collapsing under the depression conditions of those years. And the question is, what is the difference? And I think this and the idea of an actual renaissance, that it's not about who are we going to oppose, and what happens if my enemy disappears? where's my identity then? No, it's actually about this idea of creativity is crucial. What are we going to create once? It's like LaRouche once said, you don't fight a war. You fight a war for the peace. So what are you going to do with the peace? And this is the kind of stuff. When you think about Kepler, and he had this, there's this guy that he drew from, Nicholas of Cusa, Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa, who organized, remember we saw those pictures of the church in Florence? Right, well, in this, you had the Council of Florence that took place under this church, and it was Cusa's organizing which was crucial in bringing Europe out of the Dark Age. And Kepler revives the ideas of Cusa after another Dark Age, right? And the same ideas, right, being revived again. This is a thing. You think about the potential for these kinds of breakthroughs. Nobody studied this stuff in hundreds of years, and not studied it in a way that actually really understand it.
What we did?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good idea.
Yeah, we worked, there were five of us on the team from all around the country, and we worked, well, first of all, let me say, we were able to deploy five people from around the country to come, to not organize for 5 months. I didn't organize, none of us organized out politically, explicitly, for 5 months. And we were able to do that, number one, because our movement's growing. And the more our movement grows, the more we'll be able to do things like that. But we worked out of LaRouche's basement so that we could have concentration, basically. Because when you're in a very busy political office, you often get bombarded and distracted and this and that. So we worked out of a little makeshift office out of LaRouche's basement.
Lyndon LaRouche.
What's he got down there?
Is that us? Also, when he was home, he came down and he would make himself available for questions we had, things we were totally confused on. He'd pop in and throw in a very confusing and provocative idea every once in a while. Like, we had just started reading the book, and he came down and he was like, keep your eye out for the orbital characteristics that Gauss uses to determine the orbit of Ceres. And we're like, just crack that book. So we worked, there were different phases to our work. We worked, the five of us worked very, very, very closely for about 3 months in terms of like reading the book together every day, working out the problems. We read the book through a few times, probably two or three times all the way through together, pausing on this section or that section. We often had to go off and bring in kind of outside sources, you'd say. Like we went in and we brought in a lot of what we could dig up of the Greeks' works on conic sections. We went back and we read the Mysterium Cosmographicum, this earlier work of Kepler. We read the Epitome of Copernican Astronomy, which was a later work of Kepler, to bring that in to try to understand the elliptical orbit, this crazy orbit I was talking about. And we just brought in a lot of things. And we also, as long as the weather was warm, we went out and did observations too. We'd go out in the country and do observations to try to figure out it can't just be some blackboard textbook thing. You've got to actually struggle with the paradoxes that human beings struggled with throughout human culture. in the process of discovering this thing that led up to Kepler. So we really wanted to know what was in Kepler's mind. What paradoxes was he struggling with? Why did this question arise in his mind? At a certain point, we began to work a little more independently writing. And we did about a month and a half work of writing to put together, I showed it briefly the other night, but I'll show you guys again.
Oh, you gotta put it back now.
Okay. Like the power button and everything? Or
like
just the
whole thing.
Okay.
Oh.
Okay. I'll show you guys our website. And the website's something which is available to everybody to look through. We tried to make it pretty interactive where possible. So the website's kind of divided up into the five sections of the book. And tonight I kind of took you guys through sections 1, 3, and 5, or touched upon sections 1, 3, and 5. I didn't really get into 2 and 4. We tried to make it pretty easy to navigate. So the first section, we have the three subsections, which are just writings that the five of us put together on to try to help facilitate people's working through the book, and also to try to make a little bit more explicit what the real issue at hand was, because sometimes you have to do a little digging and fighting with each other about what the real issue is that Kepler is bringing up in his writing. So we tried to make that more explicit. This is a golden section thing I was talking about for you, if you want to look at it. It's my friend Vinny did a large amount of work on it. He brought in spherical trigonometry. This thing that's assigned to load. It's clear that one place where the golden section arises is in astronomy, actually, in the geometry of the celestial sphere. So he did some fun work looking at the geometry of the sphere, things like that. And then my friend Rihanna put together an entire, this is an entire adventure on the heptagon, going through the whole thing. So you guys have fun with that. And this is some fun stuff that I didn't get into. But my friend Vinny, Kepler not only looks at the planar figures, he also looks at the solid figures. Vinny put together a lot on the process of assembling kind of an ordered series of solid figures, kind of like we assembled an ordered series of the musical tones. He looks at a whole ordered series of the platonic solid, which is this cube you see here, but then also there's another solid figure inside of it, which you form by just kind of chopping off the corners. So he does a whole massive study of this. Just to provoke you guys to go look at it, what he discovered, and I think he's the first one to figure this out, to be honest, but he figured out that the volumes of the series of solids actually have the same relationships to each other that the musical tones do. The volumes of the cube, the tetrahedron, the octahedron, all these solids that you form by chopping off the corners, and when you order them, they actually form a musical scale.
What do you mean, like the volume?
The volume of the figure, if you fill the cube with water and then you fill the octahedron with water, that has a certain proportion, that volume. So there's a whole chart of it in here where you figure it out what intervals they hold to each other.
So there was another type of a platonic solid where you cut off the corners, right?
It's not a platonic solid, they're called the Archimedean solid.
Oh, okay.
Like there's one.
So that's what they're called, Archimedean solid.
Yeah, they're called Archimedean solids. There's a whole thing about it in here. Book 3 is more interactive. We have a lot of buttons with these sounds, and we had Jean-Sebastian play them on the cello so that you could actually hear these proportions, so it came to life off the page. We have a lot in here. In Book 4 is pretty beautiful. It's Kepler's philosophical exposition of why the human mind is susceptible to perceiving harmony, and how the human mind comes to know principle. And it's also a refutation of Aristotle. Very, very explicit. He says that Aristotle isn't fit for the Christian religion. Well, consider with who the church is adhering to. The big fight around that. He's pretty bold. So we put together some things on that. And then book 5 probably has the most in it. Where we go through an introduction, we go through his reflection on the Mysterium Cosmographicum hypothesis with the distances and how he modified that. In chapter 3, we go through the basic astronomical principles that you need to know. You know, like how you calculate distance, how you calculate angular velocity, and things like that. We go through the when he finally assembles the musical system, which I was showing you. We go through the asteroid belt as a provocation to figure out. And I didn't get to finish working on it, so at the bottom of the page, anybody who wants to, I have a link where I just have all the data that I used. If anybody wants to pick up on the data and take it and continue the work. So that's what we did. And there's been a press release written on it that LaRouche has commissioned to be printed up and distributed. It's been distributed in the Congress, all the offices of the U.S. Congress. Since I've been up here, I haven't heard any of the operations reports, but I heard that we went to some university campuses, to science departments over the past couple days in different cities that we organize in to challenge the heads of the science departments that this is an actual breakthrough for society right now. This is an actual a revival of a real scientific discovery. And we're going to be distributing this press release with all the information for the website and a statement about it everywhere. Mm-hmm. And this is, if people just ask, or maybe you can write up somewhere the web address if people want to write it down so they can play with it on their own.
We have a link.
Oh, yeah, from our youth movement page. There's a link. Also from your Canadian youth movement page.
Yeah, because I got to your, like a couple weeks ago to this from your...
Okay.
Okay, so I was playing around with this.
Good.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, if you were to earnestly take up the task of understanding all the books, how long would it take you to read the books and understand them?
You're talking about, all the books of Kepler?
Yeah.
Well, this is the Harmony of the World, which is it's about this big. It's divided into 5 sections. We had a pretty concentrated time, and it took us 5 months. I'm not going to say I'm not going to claim that I've, mastered the whole thing or something, but... on a certain level, I think all 5 of us that worked on it have a pretty solid understanding on a certain level. And but the point is that now that we have this website up, it's not going to take the whole movement 5 months of, that's all you do to understand this work. Because number one, you have more people collaborating than just 5, so you have more hypotheses and ideas to be brought in, more of a dialogue across the country with the different offices. And you also have the aid of what we have up on the website, so you don't have to do all that for yourself. It's all right there for you.
Is it better to look at the original text?
Yeah, we'll do both. You gotta do both. I mean, you can read through. This is ordered in the order of the book, so you can actually work through this along with the book.
5 months of how many hours a day?
We worked all day. You wake up, you go, you work, until you got tired. Yeah, we worked all the time, pretty much.
Did there ever come a point when you guys were just, we can't get there? No, was there ever a point where you guys got stopped in the books? Because you couldn't understand it?
We got really frustrated with a lot of parts of it. Like this thing that actually it's the same thing you guys all got confused about with the distance and the motion. It's actually Kepler's third law, but he doesn't call it that. But we got really stuck on that. There was a lot of frustration, but... I mean, the point is when you actually have society and not just you, locked in your room, you have many minds and you can actually flank a problem. Because everybody's unique and everybody's mind has a different perspective. You have different ideas in your mind and somebody's hypothesis can spark something in your own mind that can actually break through the problem. And that's you can only make discoveries in a social setting. I mean, in a social situation. Even though it is individuals who make discoveries. It's not a shared experience of making a discovery. It's a single mind, but it's in the context of a social process of dialogue. So, we reached points of frustration, but the point is we knew that there were 5 of us, and we'd be able, if Kepler figured it out, we could figure it out too.
Is it written in like the same style of writing as the New Astronomy? Like in terms,
no? No, it's different. The New Astronomy is a little bit more autobiographical. He kind of just relates his whole experience to you step by step. This isn't like that. I mean, it's written in this, I think it's written more like he's not walking you through the experience, but it's more of a composition. You sort of, kind of like a musical, like a symphony has like different movements of a symphony. This thing kind of has, you can think of it as a symphony with five different movements that he composed after the fact to actually help walk you through his discovery. But it's not quite as autobiographical as the New Astronomy. He's funny, though. He has a good sense of humor, so it kind of comes through.
Has anybody else done anything since then, similar to this? Like
since
after?
David?
Yeah.
Oh,
no, I mean like historically.
Nothing
or is
I
this?
Know of. I know that people like Kepler. Sorry. I know that people like Gauss did study it. Did study this, but I'd imagine I don't know who the last person to rigorously study this work was, but I mean there was definitely a complete destruction of culture beginning around the turn of the 20th century. So historically, I don't think anybody's done this. And I certainly know that there's been no mass movement of young people that have done this in all of human history. This has not been a massively disseminated discovery within culture.
Poets tend to, like Schiller, Shakespeare, I mean, you name it, there's this sort of awareness.
Yeah,
people know that every night we work on the New Astronomy, starting around 9:30. Monday, Tuesday, Friday. Friday is starting at 7 up to 11. And on Saturday as well, people want to start working with the brain on Mr. Kepler, you know, starting next Monday.
So Michelle's starting at 9 tomorrow.
What time is it now?
Well,
very early.
It's 11.
It's 11.
Yeah.